This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam peoples.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is July 22nd, 2021, and this is episode 249.
I'm Scott Lundbaum.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, it's another state of emergency, both in the province of British Columbia and seemingly in the federal Green Party, who got so close to seeming like they were pulling things together this week and then just collapsed within a couple days. We'll get into it in a bit. First, thanks to the 103 people who continue to contribute every month. It's been 103 for a while, so at this point, I'm just going to say, you know what? Thank you to each and every one of you. Patreon.com/Politicoast. Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. Let's talk about emergencies. Scott, we are back into a state of emergency. We just ended the provincial state of emergency for COVID, and now we have a state of emergency for wildfires. The province is burning.
Yeah, so I guess John Horgan's giddiness finally wore off and decided it was probably time to bring one of those back. A mere 3 weeks or so after a town in the interior was literally destroyed by fire, and subsequent evacuations were ordered in places across the interior in the following weeks.
Yeah, the initial reaction was that local states of emergency and local crews have the resources they need, and there's no value in suspending civil liberties and the rule of law, such as it's defined, to enact the state of emergency, just because it would give people some existential comfort, even if it wouldn't necessarily change anything on the ground. That seems to have shifted in the government's mind, either from political pressure or from just the sheer scale of the evacuation orders happening and the need to suspend some rights and due processes to find people shelter. So, breaking into the numbers, the BC government is now posting regular updates, almost like they do for COVID, but for BC wildfires, with quick statistics. Yesterday evening at 7 p.m., so 25 hours ago from when we were recording, there were 50 evacuation orders covering 4,351 properties and 79 evacuation alerts covering 17,691 properties. So 22,000 homes ordered or asked to go elsewhere lest you burn down. This is accounting for 277 wildfires that are burning across the province. We are not at a record level yet, but it seems like we're on pace to be up there with some of the records of 2017 and 2018, I believe. There are 338,900 hectares of the province are burned, and we have over 3,000 firefighters here from both British Columbians and people from around, I think around the world. I saw a picture of some Mexican firefighters arriving to combat the wildfires.
Yeah, so we've been bringing in help from outside as well as our internal provincial resources. So yeah, we're on track to have a pretty bad wildfire season. So we've already exceeded the last couple of years, but looks like we could hit the 2018 record if things keep up the way they are. And not entirely sure how the rest of the province has been, but I think we're now, at least in the lower mainland, this is the longest period we've gone without rain in this time of year on record, so concerning in that respect.
Yeah, on the one hand, it's nice from the, oh, it's another nice sunny summer day where I don't need to think about the weather. But yeah, everything is super dry, and it's, we could use a good rain. I think maybe we got like a light drizzle here on Coquitlam one evening, but not even enough that you needed to bring anything in kind of rain. So very dry, very hot. We had that heat wave and things never really cooled back down to average. I think the last 2 or 3 days were slightly cooler, but yeah. So it's very hot, very dry.
It's been low to mid-20s. That's pretty typical for this time.
We had weeks of high 20s, which is not. So that's all bad. Nothing's pointing to it getting better. Thankfully, the sky is still blue in the lower mainland, unlike my friends and family in Alberta who are now under smoke warnings.
Yeah, and Toronto too, I saw, which is not typical. They usually avoid the wildfires, but Northern Ontario is also experiencing some issues this year, which I gather is impacting them as well.
What's there to even say about this politically? Like, it's just such a bad situation, and it's one that's going to keep recurring with greater and greater frequency. Like, we're already seeing smoke season become a thing. We're seeing the need to bring more firefighters on, not every year, but most years in the last five.
The most interesting thing I find about this politically is the question of why now? Why did everything suddenly flip? And there was a pretty unmistakable ratcheting up of questions about why a state of emergency hadn't been declared in the, I don't know, like 4 or 5 days leading up to the province actually declaring one. That the view from the outside certainly gives the impression that the government didn't really want to do this and came around once enough pressure mounted. And that kind of ties in with the questions over why wasn't there a state of emergency called during the heat wave and all of that kind of. It's only a couple instances now, but it does seem to be the start of what could become a pattern of the government being behind the eight ball when there's warnings of potential disaster on the horizon.
So the question for me almost has to be looked at in reverse in terms of like what difference did the declaration make? I think we've seen a number of headlines that have drawn from the heat wave some stark criticism, particularly in terms of the number of excess deaths, the failure of BC EHS, the ambulance service, to keep up with what was necessary and what was asked of it. And some work is being done to improve that, thankfully. There's the part of me that does want to see hesitancy from governments to invoke things like the Emergencies Act, because these are pretty extreme tools. They should not become routine process like, oh, it's summer, time to go back into state of emergency. It's not an emergency if it's never ending. By definition, we almost need to retool our society to be better able to build some resilience in, because this is going to be an ongoing state of being. Now, on the other hand, there's this headline from Globe and Mail about how we never use the cell phone alert system. Do you want to go into that one?
Yeah, so this was reported on in the Globe and Mail looking at the emergency alert system. This is the thing that like once or twice a year your phone will buzz with this is a test of the emergency alert system.
So and we know it works.
Yeah, you may have noticed that hasn't been used any other time. Despite a raft of very serious emergencies from the recent heat wave to the biggest one in decades being the COVID-19 pandemic, you would have thought that in March of 2020, when everything shut down and all of a sudden there was a bunch of new processes, ways of living, general changes that everybody in the society needed to adopt pretty quickly on that a system to allow the pushing out of critical information in an emergency would have been ideally suited to that.
Yeah,
but nothing ever came of that.
And the Globe and Mail has a nice comparison of how each province is done. And one thing that made this a mess is it's frankly antiquated version of federalism at this point, where the federal government is in charge of telecom, so they had to get the CRTC to make sure the app or the technology was implemented across all the platforms. But responding to emergencies is largely a provincial matter. So each province decides when to actually hit the fire button on the send the alert to everyone. So you see a wild discrepancy between provinces. Like BC and Yukon have never used it. Nunavut has done it once, and this is since 2019. And on the other end, Ontario has used it 162 times, which works out to about every 5 days you're getting an alert from the government. Now, I think they can micro-target it a little bit better than province-wide, because everyone would stop paying attention to the province crying wolf that much.
Yeah, and I believe... I know Ontario has a system to push out alerts for Amber Alerts as well, which have been the source of a fair bit of controversy when those things go off at 4 a.m. In places. I'm not sure if it's the same system and gets counted in on it, but that was definitely a topic of conversation in Ontario a year or two ago. Or, say, wasn't during the pandemic. A couple of years back. On this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's definitely limits on that. You don't want it to go off every single time because it does need to be there for an emergency. On the other hand, people know the system's there, and they will because they get the alerts every year when they test the system. When there is a serious emergency, whether it be a pandemic, fires destroying towns in the interior, any of these things, and there doesn't... And an alert doesn't get sent out, the natural response might be to wonder, how bad can it really be if the government isn't using the emergency alert system they have? And that could end up creating a false sense of security.
So the BC government's emergency website does state that Emergency Management BC has a policy to only use the alert ready to notify of a potential tsunami, which is... legitimately an emergency threat worth notifying people quickly of.
Yeah, it's serious. They can come up rather quickly. Calming problem when tsunamis have hit places is that the water recedes immediately before a tsunami hits, and that's not usual, and people get curious and come out to check it out. So if they know that there's a tsunami on the way, they might not do that. So it makes a huge amount of sense to have it in that case, but also tsunamis are pretty rare. I think the last one that caused any significant damage in BC was in, like, 1964.
Is that the Port Alberni one?
That's the Port Alberni one.
So, important.
Yeah, I think there was a landslide near Kitimat in the 70s that caused the tsunami. I don't know how much damage came out of that one. But occasionally tsunami watches get posted when there's an earthquake anywhere around the Pacific Rim. But I don't think they actually trigger the alerts unless the tsunami buoy is in the ocean detect that there's a wave on its way. So, like, it's a fairly rare thing, and there are a lot more potential hazards than just tsunami.
Yeah. So, what I also find interesting about this whole discussion is how, like, non-A or apartisan it is. This is just a core competency that any government of any stripe needs to have. You need to be able to respond to emergencies. There's not a lot of ideological debate, I think, that can come down to what is a competent and what is not a competent response.
Yeah, there's, outside the nuttiest of the libertarians, there's really no disagreement among any political faction on the need to be able to respond to emergencies. But also, it's not clear that any of them are doing a particularly great job. And one other thing that was highlighted in the story is that this is only held at the provincial level. Cities and more local levels, the ones that we were just talking about, how they were declaring their own states of emergencies in relation to the fires, don't have the ability to do that and don't have access to the system. So are stuck trying to set up some third-party system that requires people to sign up proactively and just... there's no way it's going to be anywhere near as effective.
So we need more resiliency in this province. But yeah, in the meantime, my heart goes out to everyone evacuated or under threat of evacuation. It's terrifying to think of, especially after we saw what happened in Lytton. And I heard it's on fire again. Feels unfair.
The area surrounding or the town itself? Because there isn't much flammable material left from the pictures I've seen.
There's a new evacuation order issued for areas near Lytton. I guess anything that's left in the area is now on fire again, so... Terrible.
Moving on to our next segment, BC's not the only thing that's on fire, as the Green Party continues to torch itself. I'm not sure what the right metaphor you want to use here is, but just absolutely going at each other in the most distracting ways. We've been talking about this for the last couple of weeks because it is both fascinating to watch in the sort of disaster movie sort of way. And
frankly, because the stakes are so low.
Yeah, there's that. And it's just interesting to see a party just absolutely try and fight out amongst themselves in the lead up to a fairly significant election.
So this week was supposed to be the, I don't know, big confrontation week. The non-confidence motion about Annamie Paul was going to be heard on Tuesday, July 20th by the National Council. And that's when we were going to find out if the council was going to vote non-confidence, and that would send it to a membership meeting to decide whether she could stay on as leader. What happened on Monday was weird because the party posted a short notice on its website that the non-confidence motion was not going to be heard, as well as a motion that the investigation into her membership, which I don't even remember if we talked about.
But we did like briefly mention, I think, last week.
Okay. This kind of backdoor effort to get her out of the party was also suspended. And that all seemed okay. Maybe they're just like trying to move on, put water under the bridge. Until next day, it came out that they're going to court to, like, the party is suing her, Annamie Paul. I guess they're technically trying to overturn an arbitrator's decision, and it's an arbitration decision that forced the Green Party Council to put these statements out and to suspend their attacks on her. So essentially, they are in a mired legal battle with their leader, and the party is now suing to continue trying to get her out of the party.
I had hoped on Monday that was a sign that they were, I know, at least going to hold their fire until the election was over, and you know, try and just have a party that's there to contest the election. But no, they've decided to go for the most unprecedented option on the table, I think. I cannot think of any instance of a party leader and their party in a legal battle with each other.
Yeah, like the party will get into legal battles with members or like other debates around, or leadership candidates have had legal battles with the party in the past. It's never usually in the lead up to an election.
Yeah, and it's never the leader. Like, it's not uncommon for something to either threat of a lawsuit, or I think they occasionally even get filed when someone doesn't get greenlit, for example. But with a leader elected by the party members, the two going to court is, as far as I know, something that's never happened in Canada before.
And it's actually pretty wild because the arbitrator's decision postponed the confidence vote and membership review for about a month. So the council didn't have to bring any of this to light if they were just wanting to be patient and just abide by this agreement. But instead, they've decided that no, we need to get her out as soon as possible, and we're willing to burn everything down in the process.
Yeah, that was one of the most striking things, is that there was no need to push ahead on this. They could have just taken their time, but it's clearly they are so motivated for some reason that is still not entirely clear on this, on the need to just kick her out of the party as quickly as possible. And yeah, it really just, I think, speaks to the state of mind of everyone involved. Well, I don't want to say everyone involved, but definitely the party board executive committee. I'm not sure exactly what title they use on that, on the mindsets there.
And the legal arguments they're using to fight the arbitrator decision are somewhat obscure. On the first one, they say it's not the Green Party that is the employer in this situation. It's the Green Party fund that had the deal with Annamie Paul. And so the Green Party can't be restrained in its actions because it's the Green Party in triple parentheses, or whatever it is the Freeman on the land use, the natural person of the Green Party.
I think they don't capitalize their name and stick random punctuations in places. I don't know. It's so hard to keep up with that stuff. Nor is one inclined.
They also try to argue that as a member of the Green Party, the code of conduct applies, and therefore a review of whether she broke it is valid and should not restrict the Green Party from persecuting her. This whole thing is stupid. And like, early on, I think we had a lot of criticism for Annamie Paul's handling and her a like capacity within the Green Party, but every step of the way, it's getting more and more apparent how vindictive and how much the council themselves despises her in an irrational way.
She still has a lot of problems. We've touched on the decision to run Toronto Centre, which I think just speaks to a pretty severe level of political naivete, but putting that aside, it's definitely the case that she is by far the more sympathetic figure in this particular battle, just because they are just, as you said, so vindictive on it. And I don't know the exact legal structures of the payments and whatnot, but I could definitely see the case that could be argued that there is just some sort of contractual relationship between Paul and the Green Party overall, and whether or not that has an arbitration, would include an arbitration provision is something that I just don't have legal expertise to weigh in on, but it strikes me as somewhat questionable on the, we just have no reason to be in this case at all for that.
This gets even better because Elizabeth May was asked for comment on this, and she said, "I fully support the Green Party of Canada, our values, and our constitution. Our leader is Annamie Paul, and only our members have the authority to call that into question," which is not exactly a vote of confidence.
I don't even know what to say anymore on this. It's like every week they hit a new level of weird, vindictive, just that the story keeps getting more and more nuts every week, and I honestly am not sure where this is going to end, but it's been something to watch, and particularly as just like a year or two ago, we were talking about how the Green Party was on the rise. They were, in 2019, they'd won their first seat in New Brunswick federally. They had their largest caucus ever. They were reasonably well represented in a couple different provincial legislatures. And now this, they're just intent on destroying it all, because whether or not you think Paul should stay leader of the Green Party, going about it in this fashion is just going to absolutely wreck them. And for what? Like, what's the point of kicking out a bad leader if there's no party left when you do it, or after you finish it?
I want to flag two other Green Party-related newses. First, I'll just mention that in the Taii, there's a nice long-form interview piece that came out on Tuesday by Christopher Gully, titled "The Man Who Upended Canada's Green Party," and he has a extended interview with Noah Zatzman, the guy who Annamie Paul refused to condemn, though he was a brief aide advisor to the party, and most famously suggested the party should run against and campaign against its own MPs. But the article is really interesting, and it goes a lot into Zatzman's thinking and who he is, because he's such a character in this. And then the other thing is former Green Party leadership candidate, the actual runner-up to Annamie Paul, Dimitri Lascaris, has launched greenleft.ca, which initially I think a lot of people thought was a splinter party to try to further split the
It's not entirely clear. But like he pitches it as an organization, movement type thing. That's not necessarily separate from the Green Party, but also not clearly like within it either.
And he says pretty clearly on Twitter it's not going to be a standalone party, at least.
And also, like, Green Left is the name of a couple different Green Parties in Europe. So, like, it's not, like, there's ties there. You can see in like the context of that where that concern comes from.
If we had proportional representation, we could have all of the different Green Parties going. I think the Beaverton had a great headline today, as it said the Green Party is seeking to split into the respective blue and yellow parties. So that's the Greens. What else is happening in federal election speculation news?
Yeah, the ever-present question of what does any random event mean for Mark Carney's electoral prospects was finally answered this week. Nothing, because he will not be running in the upcoming election if it is called in the fall.
Yes, he has a very important job, he says, to organize the private financial sector in the run-up to the United Nations Climate Conference this fall, which runs from October 31st to November 12th, which is not even as good as I want to run to be the leader of OPEC in terms of your...
OECD, not OPEC.
OECD, yeah, that makes more sense. I don't want to... That level of argument, the... So, here we are, Mark Carney's not running. It's weird. It suggests to me at least something else is going on. Maybe Trudeau wouldn't give him a cabinet promise that he wanted, or maybe there's some like secret skeletons in Carney's closet that they don't want to get out. I can't imagine what that would be.
I think the latter is unlikely, because he did have two top jobs, the governor of the Bank of Canada and then the Bank of England. He would have been vetted as part of the appointments process for both of them. And if there was something disqualifying, he would not have been brought on, particularly on the Bank of England one, I would have think, because that was a fairly unprecedented move, bringing someone from outside the UK in for that role. So they would have definitely done their homework on that one. You know, yeah, it does feel like there's something more going on, because every indication in the lead up to this announcement was that he was going to run. I think the most likely scenario is there was some sort of breakdown in the negotiations on that. Because I'm sure organizing the financial sector in the lead up to some UN conference is not unimportant, but it's also not a job that only Mark Carney can do and nobody else could fill in for. If running and being part of, you know, Team Trudeau and the stuff he indicated he was supportive of before was that important, he could find a way to run, and even if it meant stepping aside from something. So it does indicate that there's more going on.
Maybe he talked to Catherine McKenna or the staff of Carolyn Bennett's office and realized he did not want to be part of this government. But Mark Carney is not the only person in or out of the federal election. There's news that former MP and former leadership candidate Brad Trost is angling for a nomination again in Saskatchewan. He wants to return to the federal scene.
Was anyone really asking for this?
No.
He lost his nomination in 2019, which is fairly rare for a sitting MP.
Yeah.
He did fairly well in the last leadership race, or the leadership race before last, when he was one of 14, I want to say, candidates, and managed to do reasonably well on the social conservative vote before that capped out at 30% of the party and couldn't get him any further on that. And actually, didn't even hit 30%. But while that, you know, one minority segment of the party kind of boosted him, I think, into a fourth place finish.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, because it was Scheer, Bernier, O'Toole, Trost, Chong, I think is how it shook out in that case. Yeah, he managed to capture one constituency in a leadership race, but that wasn't enough to get him over the finish line there, nor do I think his riding has so much concentration of social conservatives that it's going to guarantee him a spot. So, I don't know, we'll see. He's apparently been greenlit by the party, considering some of his past dates may not be ideal, but there's probably going to be a knockdown, drag-out fight over it.
Yeah, that he's going for the federal conservatives is interesting. He definitely fits very much in line with the Derek Sloan image. Although I don't recall Trost ever going down the like full conspiracy theorist kind of paranoia stuff that Sloan seems to have bought in, especially through COVID.
I think Trost is too bland to ever do any of that stuff.
He'd want to regulate the women's bodies and stop the gays, conservative. And ended at that. Yeah, maybe he'll get it. The party, I think, does not want him back. So,
yeah, it's also worth mentioning he got into a legal scrap with the party, to tie it back into what we were just talking about, because apparently the party list that his campaign was provided got leaked or got given to some firearms group.
Who used it for NRA of Canada, except we don't have a...
It wasn't even that. Like,
big thing.
Like, they're definitely, you know, more pro-gun-ish, but like not anywhere near the NRA's level of crazy. But yeah, that whole thing turned into a legal fight after the party refused to refund him his deposit on the campaign. So yeah, just another reason why he's probably not going to be super welcomed in this. Although it does raise the question why, if that had happened in the past, they couldn't have just taken the excuse of that to not greenlight him.
And the other bit of conservative who's in, who's out speculation is this super speculative poll that Paul Wells writes about for Maclean's, where they asked Innovative Research to say, all right, do your standard poll of who would you vote for, but then say, what if Erin O'Toole wasn't leader, and what if Stephen Harper came back? And fascinatingly, they find that the Liberal lead would drop from 14 points under O'Toole as Conservative leader to just 5 points with Harper trying to rematch Justin Trudeau. What did you think of this?
I'm not entirely sure what to make of it. On one hand, I think O'Toole still has a bit of a name recognition problem, which someone who was prime minister for, 9.5 years doesn't have. Like, O'Toole's going to be coming up on a year in the job in the next month and a half or so. But during pandemic times, it's been particularly tough for opposition parties to get attention, and it's never easy, but it's been harder for that. So there may be a bit of that going on. There's probably some of the parked in the other vote category in the prairies that Harper's name is reassuring to and will bring those voters back in the fold. Some of whom I think probably would have come back around once the campaign got underway anyway, but now are more happy to tell a pollster they would do that. I'm honestly not sure who the... let's pull it up. I think it was 11% of likely Liberal or intends to vote Liberal voters who would change their vote to Harper. I'm honestly not quite sure what to make of those.
Yeah, that's quite the statement. Under Harper, the NDP's support only goes from 17 to 16%, so it's a negligible change. But the pollster does say, like, a big chunk of the support comes from those People's Party maverick in the prairies. So Harper takes a lead from 17 points up to 28 points in the prairies, which is not where the Conservatives need to rack up the wins. O'Toole is bleeding hard there in a way the Conservatives haven't for a long time. And that does start to put, you know, high single, low double digit seats into play in Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. The Conservatives need a lot more than just sweeping the prairies to take government. There's a little suggestion in here they could do a bit better in Quebec, which would be interesting. But like, it's so speculative. Yeah, it relies on this idea that there wouldn't be a campaign, and if there was, that somehow Harper today would be the one people are imagining.
Yeah, so on the Quebec thing, I think Harper topped out at, 10 seats in Quebec? It's hardly a huge win to go back to it. He was never all that popular in the province. He's well-liked by conservatives. Like, there's still, I think, a lot of good feelings towards him for people who are Conservative Party first voters. But yeah, I think once it gets into the campaign, there hasn't been enough distance between his time as prime minister and now for there not to be a bunch of stuff the campaign kicks up and all the unpopular decisions or events of his prime ministership get relitigated. So yeah, I'm not quite sure to make of it beyond that.
I think the key takeaway is the immortal words of Michael Harris, October 26, 2015, Harper is still lurking, be vigilant.
He wrote another one of those pieces like a week ago. The man really needs a new shtick.
I've only saved 2 tweets in my life, and that's one of them, just because I love going back to it. I guess we'll keep speculating about the federal election until it's finally called. Or maybe Trudeau will be too worried about Harper coming back, or Mark Carney not getting into his cabinet, or not having Mark Carney come to his cabinet. So maybe it won't happen and we'll have just wasted your listening time for the last few weeks speculating endlessly.
It's summer. There needs to be something to keep the punditry going. And
we need to get interviews with BC Liberal leadership candidates. That's what we're pledging to do for the next month, listeners. We will do it, we promise. Let's jump into quick takes. One place they will be going to the polls is in Nova Scotia, as Premier Ian Rankin has called an election for August 17th.
Yeah, so this is Rankin's first election as party leader. He took over from Stephen McNeil earlier in the year. I don't have a huge amount of insight into Nova Scotia politics. I think the Liberals are most likely going to be able to win for the little bit I've seen. It does, of course, raise the question of how that ties in with the federal election on this and how much potential overlap there is. I think generally politicians try and avoid doing that, although it's happened before. Including, I think, in 2019. Yeah, mostly just threw this in there as something to note. Although the first controversy of the campaigns already, I think, kicked into national news.
I don't think I saw that.
Oh, that was the candidate that stepped down after
the boudoir photo.
After the boudoir photos.
Yes. The party knew about that this candidate had taken boudoir photos, and it initially greenlit her. And then decided to yank her nomination at the last minute. Very classy. Anyway, the Nova Scotia Liberals are hoping to increase their 24 seats in the legislature. There are currently 51 MLAs, but they'll be electing 55. The polls show it's a pretty good shot for them to take a strong majority, as most parties seem to be doing, as you mentioned, during a pandemic.
Moving back here to BC, there's a new LNG project that was announced. This one being spearheaded by the Nisga'a Nation. I think hope I pronounced that correctly.
I think it's Nisga.
Nisga. I'm not quite sure if that apostrophe is a glottal stop or not. Hawaii is supposed to be pronounced. Anyway, languages are not all languages are easily rendered in Latin script. Anyway, they announced earlier this week the intention to move ahead with the $10 billion LNG project north of Prince Rupert, right near the Alaskan border.
This will be the largest net zero LNG export facility in the world. And so the idea here is to build a giant fossil fuel extraction or shipping export facility, but then offset it through using hydroelectricity to run it, buying carbon offsets, planting some trees, that kind of thing, and some carbon capture and storage, so they can at least claim this project has not made the world closer to apocalypse, even as it's a giant fossil fuel extraction project. So
the carbon offsets and carbon capture and storage bit of that do seem to be doing quite a bit of the heavy lifting on the net zero claims on that.
Yeah, net zero's such an interesting concept. Like, it was just passed as a federal accountability act that will achieve net zero, but net zero depends a lot on accounting. So in a project like this, are you counting the emissions from the facility itself only, or are you also counting up and downstream emissions from the LNG that's going through it? And depending how you do that, it gets much easier or much harder to offset it all.
Yeah, it's not necessarily easy to tell where the final product will end up being used either, and what the use there is, and tracking all of that too. There will be a use for LNG in the foreseeable future. I think probably the most obvious case of application that is just hard to move away from fossil fuels entirely is long distance shipping. So you could definitely see a case where it replaces the very dirty sulfur filled, carbon filled bunker oil that currently gets burned in a lot of shipping. Well, I think there's been some recent maritime standards that are starting to move away from that. But there's definitely cases where the offset or displacement is a viable midterm method or solution in that. But at the same time, I mean, I haven't looked at the numbers, but I would have to presume that the total demand for that has got to be smaller than the current output of natural gas worldwide.
So this project is still interesting to me. The Nisga'a were one of the first, I believe, indigenous nations in BC to sign one of the modern treaties in 2000. They signed that with the governments of Canada and BC, giving the Nisga'a control over 2,000 square kilometers of their territory in the Nass Valley in the northwest of the province. So this is, in many ways, a good example of nations taking control of their own prosperity. I still have my hesitations about the long-term climate effects of LNG, even if you try to make it net zero. But
yeah, this is fascinating for me because it does get at one of the tensions that is definitely out there between climate action and reconciliation, and the question of whether climate action is colonialist. It's not something that's typically asked, but we may be hearing more about in the coming years. And there is a real tension here because the various nations do need and desire to pursue economic development. And that's not necessarily easy. And the hand wavy, oh, don't worry, the Green New Deal stuff will all fix this, it doesn't really stand up once if you look too closely at it, because a lot of these areas don't have a huge amount of other obvious development opportunities for their economies. This is at the end of a deep fjord, near the mouth of a deep fjord in a mountainous region that's cloudy most of the time, all of which act to preclude onshore, offshore wind or solar, the obvious renewable options, the service economy that most Canadians are employed with. I think it's most Canadians are employed in. That happens in cities because you need people to provide services too. So they tend to cluster. The North Coast is not one of those areas. And there's just there's just not a lot of obvious places or a lot of obvious alternative development opportunities for a lot of these nations beyond pursuing resource projects.
So we'll keep our eye on that development along with the other LNG projects that are under development in the province. But under new rules just amended this past week, 14 and 15-year-olds probably won't be able to work on those projects, as BC has raised the general working age back to 16 from 14. Children can't work anymore in this province. What is this all coming to? This change is mostly my excuse to rant about how the Gordon Campbell government in the early 2000s went so hard in on deregulation that they were doing things like eliminating requirements for like minimum age for most jobs. Like they did keep it, but they did lower the working age from 16 down to 14 for most jobs. This new change is a regulatory one that means with parental permission, a 14 or 15-year-old can work certain jobs, generally service, or like you could do a programming job if you have the skills for that. Anything that's not generally unsafe or dangerous. It's just wild to me that we had some of the laxest child labor laws in the continent, and it's 2021.
I think I was probably around 16 when I had my first kind of actual paycheck job. Yeah, it seems, I think, a pretty common first job age. And yeah, the 14s, that's got to be an edge case in most of those cases. I can't imagine there's a huge amount of uptake before.
It really depends on family situation. So you'll get families where I think most people, the culture isn't to send your 14 or 15-year-old off to a job. It's you should focus on school. But you get situations where culturally, and I'm not even trying to bring race into it, but it's just like the culture of that family, whether they're white, immigrant, or otherwise, think younger teenagers should be working to earn their place. And these changes, I think, do create a good protection for children, because we do have obligations under the Convention on Rights of the Child. And ideally, these teenagers are in school or getting some form of education so that they can be better prepared for the world when they are a bit older. So not rules I think most people are going to be strongly critical of, but ones that are nice to see change. I'm actually surprised the NDP didn't change these sooner.
Yeah, it's a little weird they've waited until their second term to do this. Well, moving on, the story we cut for time last week, but definitely wanted to touch on, is the continuing battle between the city of Penticton and the BC government over whether or not to permit a homeless shelter in the city of Penticton. As it was last week, Penticton took the government to court over this, over whether or not the provincial government could overrule their powers under the Community Charter of Local Government Act.
Yeah, the province under David Eby, Attorney General, had invoked Section 14.2 of the Interpretation Act to use paramountcy powers to basically say BC Housing and the government doesn't need to follow local zoning regulations. The city claims that's not what these provisions of the act were intended or interpreted to confer, and is arguing that essentially the government is doing an end round of the processes it can and should hold. So the city would rather have said the city doesn't want the province to build the social housing, but the province could have passed a new law or used parts of the community charter to invoke its will. But instead, by using paramountcy, they are trying to overrule the city and further are actually furthering not a provincial priority, which is what I think the city is saying paramountcy is about, but are actually trying to transfer lands via BC Housing to a private landowner where the shelter would be built. So it's not that this province is trying to commandeer the land for public good, but is trying to act as an intermediary partner in this, which is not how they think it should be used. This is pretty deep in the weeds of the legal interpretation of sections of the Constitution and Interpretation Acts that I can't say I'm very familiar with, so I have no clue how strong the city versus the province's argument will be in this.
Yeah, so I just pulled up Section 14.2 of the Act, and yeah, it does, from my cursory just glance at the text, does seem to exempt the province from necessarily being bound by other acts they've passed that relate to planning, construction, alteration. But I've not dug into this enough to know what the limits on that are, because I presume they can't just willy-nilly just on a whim decide to do that. Ontario has a system of ministerial zoning orders that is written into their version of the Local Government Act that allows the applicable minister to just issue a zoning change as part of their powers. And if we had a system like that, I think it would actually probably make this a lot clearer and may help avoid the confusion on this. The other interesting thing I'll note is we did speculate on why BC moved to intervene in the case between the City of Toronto and the province of Ontario over Ontario's change to the Toronto City Council, and this does make me wonder if they wanted to maintain or have the precedent be such that they weren't unduly limited in their abilities to deal with the cities as a province.
So it's always fun to watch the various levels of government go to court against each other. I think Penticton has said they're willing to spend up to $300,000 of their local money on this, which is, Penticton's not a big town, so that's an ambitious court battle they're ready to fight over a homeless shelter. Seems like there are better things you could do with it, but I'll leave that up to the voters of Penticton to decide.
Yeah, as like a general matter of public policy, I do think it would be good if the province took a more active role in setting the various land use constraints or limiting them as such across the province. I think it's pretty clear at this point that the current structure does not actually work that well to advance a bunch of public policy goals and reforms needed. Nevertheless, this does feel a little, I guess, ham-fisted, or not, maybe not quite ham-fisted, doesn't really feel like it's going in that direction as much as it should, or feels kind of a little bit of kind of small potatoes on that sort of thing, and depending on how clear the Interpretation Act is, potentially a little questionable compared to a structural change in the legislation.
Yeah. So we'll keep watching this. It'll be interesting to see how the courts decide on this. Finally, I just want to flag a really interesting piece that just came out in Canadian Geographic by Robert Jago, who's of the Kwantlen First Nation, entitled Renaming Places, How Canada is Reexamining the Map. It starts off with a long discussion about how City Council in Toronto is renaming Dundas Street, but more relevant for our listeners will be the latter half of the article, which gets into the history of how this province got its name, British Columbia. It's actually a bit of a apocryphal story. There's not exactly one agreed reason of why we picked this name. I guess when Sir Bulwer Lytton was trying to get the New Caledonia Bill through Parliament to create British Columbia, create this province, to establish some territory for the Fraser River Gold Rush, there was
a lot of different expansion of the Americans.
Exactly. There were a lot of different names being bandied about. New Caledonia seemed leading, but it wasn't super preferred by a lot of people. So they went around. There was actually discussion in Parliament about trying to use local Indigenous names, as was becoming a custom at that exact point in time.
Well, it's sort of be more than just that at that time, because Quebec, Ontario, Manitoba, and Saskatchewan all derived from Indigenous names.
Good point. There was some willingness and eagerness to do that for this area, but they hadn't found one yet, and eventually they really needed to get the bill passed, so they needed to put a name to the province on it, and they chose British Columbia. There's one story that it was the Queen's suggestion. There's another that it was pretty much just like a bunch of white supremacists who were like, we like Columbus and we want to be clear about it being British, and let's go with that. The interesting bit at the end, though, is that the signing took place in Fort Langley, most famously, and one of Jago's great-grandfathers was actually there at the signing on behalf of the Kwantlen people, and has some poetry where it ends with the beginning of the world, and he says that an option would have been to have used the name, the Hunkamenum name for the world, which is Soltomic, which I think is actually a nice name over British Columbia. But anyway, it's a good read. Definitely go through it.
It was an interesting article. I'm not sold on the renaming suggestion just in general, but yeah, the article was interesting, had some interesting bits in it. So we'll throw a link in the show notes.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.